In 1969, there were 502 convictions for tax fraud. Such cases, called white-collar crimes, usually involve people with a good deal of money. Of those convicted, 20% ended up in jail. The fraud averaged $190,000 per case. Their sentences averaged 7 months. That same year, for burglary and auto theft, crimes of the poor, 60% ended up in prison. The auto thefts averaged $992. The sentences averaged 18 months. The burglaries averaged $321. The sentences averaged 33 months. Willard Galen, a psychiatrist, relates, partial justice, a case which, with changes in details, could be multiplied thousands of times. He had just interviewed 17 Jehovah's Witnesses who refused to register for the draft during the Vietnam War, and all had received two-year sentences. He came to a young black man who had notified his draft board he could not in conscience cooperate with the draft because he was repelled by the violence of the Vietnam War. He received a five-year sentence. Galen writes, "Hanks was the first five-year sentence I had encountered. He was also the first black man." There were additional factors. "How was your hair then?" I asked. "Afro." "And what were you wearing?" "A dashiki." "Don't you think that might have affected your sentence?" "Of course." "Was it worth a year or two of your life?" I asked. "That's all of my life," he said, looking at me with a combination of dismay and confusion. "Man, don't you know that's what it's all about? Am I free to have my style? Am I free to have my hair? Am I free to have my skin?" "Of course," I said. "You're right." Galen found enormous discretion given to judges in the handing out of sentences. In Oregon, of 33 men convicted of violating the draft law, 18 were put on probation. In southern Texas, of 16 men violating the same law, none was put on probation. And in southern Mississippi, every defendant was convicted and given the maximum of 5 years. In one part of the country, New England, the average sentence for all crimes was 11 months. In another part, the South, it was 78 months. But it wasn't simply a matter of North and South. In New York City, one judge handling 673 persons brought before him for public drunkenness, all poor, the rich get drunk behind closed doors, discharged 531 of them. Another judge, handling 566 persons on the same charge, discharged one person. With such power in the hands of the courts, the poor, the black, the odd, the homosexual, the hippie, the radical, are not likely to get equal treatment before judges who are almost uniformly white, upper-middle-class, orthodox. While in any one year, 1972, for instance, perhaps 375,000 people will be in jail, county or city, or in prison, state or federal, and 54,000 in juvenile detention, there will also be 900,000 under probation and 300,000 on parole, a total of 1,600,000 people affected by the criminal justice system. Considering turnover in any one year, several million people will come in and go out of this system. It is a population largely invisible to middle-class America, but if 20 million blacks could be invisible for so long, why not 4 or 5 million criminals? A study by the Children's Defense Fund, Thomas Cottle, Children in Jail, in the mid-70s, revealed that more than 900,000 young people under 18 are jailed in the course of a year. Anyone trying to describe the reality of prison falters. A man in Walpole Prison in Massachusetts wrote, "Every program that we get is used as a weapon against us. The right to go to school, to go to church, to have visitors, to write, to go to the movies. They all end up being weapons of punishment. None of the programs are ours. Everything is treated as a privilege that can be taken away from us. The result is insecurity, a frustration that keeps eating away at you." Another Walpole prisoner. "I haven't eaten in the mess hall for 4 years. I just couldn't take it anymore. You'd go into the serving line in the morning and 100 or 200 cockroaches would go running away from the trays. The trays were grimy and the food was raw or had dirt or maggots in it. Many a night I'd go hungry, living on peanut butter and sandwiches, getting a loaf of bread here or a hunk of bologna there. Other guys couldn't do that because they didn't have my connections or they didn't have money for the canteen." Communication with the outside world was difficult. Guards would tear up letters. Others would be intercepted and read. Jerry Souza, a prisoner at Walpole in 1970, sent two letters, one to a judge, the other to the parole board, to tell about a beating by guards. They went unanswered. 8 years later, at a court hearing, he discovered the prison authorities had intercepted them, never sent them out. The family suffered with the prisoner. During the last lockup, my 4-year-old son sneaked off into the yard and picked me a flower. A guard in the tower called the warden's office, and a deputy came in with the state police at his side. He announced that if any child went into the yard and picked another flower, all visits would be terminated. The prison rebellions of the late 60s and early 70s had a distinctly different character than the earlier ones. The prisoners in the Queen's House of Detention referred to themselves as revolutionaries. All over the country, prisoners were obviously affected by the turmoil in the country, the Black Revolt, the youth upsurge, the anti-war movement. The events of those years underlined what prisoners already sensed, that whatever crimes they had committed, the greatest crimes were being committed by the authorities who maintained the prisons, by the government of the United States. The law was being broken daily by the president, sending bombers to kill, sending men to be killed, outside the Constitution, outside the highest law of the land. State and local officials were violating the civil rights of Black people, which was against the law, and were not being prosecuted for it. Literature about the Black movement, books on the war, began to seep into the prisons. The example set in the streets by Blacks, by anti-war demonstrators, was exhilarating. Against the lawless system, defiance was the only answer. It was a system which sentenced Martin Sostra, a 52-year-old Black man running an Afro-Asian bookstore in Buffalo, New York, to 25 to 30 years in prison for allegedly selling $15 worth of heroin to an informer who later recanted his testimony. The recantation did not free Sostra. He could find no court, including the Supreme Court of the United States, to revoke the judgment. He spent 8 years in prison, was beaten 10 times by guards, spent 3 years in solitary confinement, battling and defying the authorities all the way until his release. Such injustice deserved only rebellion. There had always been political prisoners, people sent to jail for belonging to radical movements, for opposing war. But now a new kind of political prisoner appeared, the man or woman convicted of an ordinary crime, who in prison became awakened politically. Some prisoners began making connections between their personal ordeal and the social system. They then turned not to individual rebellion, but to collective action. They became concerned, amid an environment whose brutality demanded concentration on one's own safety, an atmosphere of cruel rivalry, for the rights, the safety of others. George Jackson was one of these new political prisoners. In Soledad Prison, California, on an indeterminate sentence for a $70 robbery, having already served 10 years of it, Jackson became a revolutionary. He spoke with a fury that matched his condition. "This monster, the monster they've engendered in me, will return to torment its maker, from the grave, the pit, the profoundest pit. Hurl me into the next existence. The descent into hell won't turn me. I'm going to charge them reparations in blood. I'm going to charge them like a maddened, wounded, rogue male elephant, ears flared, trunk raised, trumpet blaring. War without terms." A prisoner like this would not last, and when his book Soledad Brother became one of the most widely read books of Black militancy in the United States, by prisoners, by Black people, by white people, perhaps this ensured he would not last. He further wrote, "All my life I've done exactly what I wanted to do just when I wanted, no more, perhaps less sometimes, but never any more, which explains why I had to be jailed. I never adjusted. I haven't adjusted even yet, with half of my life already in prison." He knew what might happen. Born to a premature death, a menial subsistence wage worker, odd job man, the cleaner, the caught, the man under hatches, without bail. That's me, the colonial victim. Anyone who can pass the civil service examination today can kill me tomorrow. with complete immunity. In August 1971, he was shot in the back by guards at San Quentin Prison while he was allegedly trying to escape. The state story, analyzed by Eric Mann and Comrade George, was full of holes. Prisoners in jails and state prisons all over the country knew even before the final autopsy was in, even before later disclosures suggested a government plot to kill Jackson, that he had been murdered for daring to be a revolutionary in prison. Shortly after Jackson's death, there was a chain of rebellions around the country, in San Jose Civic Center Jail, in Dallas County Jail, in Suffolk County Jail in Boston, in Cumberland County Jail in Bridgeton, New Jersey, in Bexar County Jail in San Antonio, Texas. The most direct effect of the George Jackson murder was the rebellion at Attica Prison in September 1971, a rebellion that came from long, deep grievances, but that was raised to boiling point by the news about George Jackson. Attica was surrounded by a 30-foot wall, 2 feet thick, with 14 gun towers. 54% of the inmates were black. 100% of the guards were white. Prisoners spent 14 to 16 hours a day in their cells. Their mail was read, their reading material restricted, their visits from families conducted through a mesh screen, their medical care disgraceful, their parole system inequitable, racism everywhere. How perceptive the prison administration was about these conditions can be measured by the comment of the superintendent of Attica, Vincent Mancusi, when the uprising began. Why are they destroying their home? Most of the Attica prisoners were there as a result of plea bargaining. Of 32,000 felony indictments a year in New York State, 4,000 to 5,000 were tried. The rest, about 75%, were disposed of by deals made under duress, called plea bargaining, described as follows in the report of the Joint Legislative Committee on Crime in New York. The final climactic act in the plea bargaining procedure is a charade which in itself has aspects of dishonesty which rival the original crime in many instances. The accused is made to assert publicly his guilt on a specific crime, which in many cases he has not committed. In some cases, he pleads guilty to a non-existing crime. He must further indicate that he is entering his plea freely and that he is not doing so because of any promise made to him. In plea bargaining, the accused pleads guilty, whether he is or not, and saves the state the trouble of a trial in return for the promise of a less severe punishment. When Attica prisoners were up for parole, the average time of their hearing, including the reading of the file and deliberation among the three members, was 5.9 minutes. Then the decision was handed out, with no explanation. The official report on the Attica uprising tells how an inmate-instructed sociology class there became a forum for ideas about change. Then there was a series of organized protest efforts, and in July, an inmate manifesto setting forth a series of moderate demands, after which tensions at Attica had continued to mount, culminating in a day of protest over the killing of George Jackson at San Quentin, during which few inmates ate at lunch and dinner, and many wore black armbands. On September 9, 1971, a series of conflicts between prisoners and guards ended with a group of inmates breaking through a gate with a defective weld and taking over one of the four prison yards, with 40 guards as hostages. Then followed 5 days in which the prisoners set up a remarkable community in the yard. A group of citizen observers, invited by the prisoners, included New York Times columnist Tom Wicker, who wrote A Time to Die. The racial harmony that prevailed among the prisoners, it was absolutely astonishing. That prison yard was the first place I have ever seen where there was no racism. One black prisoner later said, I never thought whites could really get it on, but I can't tell you what the yard was like. I actually cried, it was so close, everyone so together. After 5 days, the state lost patience. Governor Nelson Rockefeller approved a military attack on the prison. See Cinda Firestone's stunning film, Attica. National guardsmen, prison guards, and local police went in with automatic rifles, carbines, and submachine guns in a full-scale assault on the prisoners, who had no firearms. 31 prisoners were killed. The first stories given the press by prison authorities said that 9 guards held hostage had their throats slashed by the prisoners during the attack. The official autopsies had almost immediately showed this to be false. The 9 guards died in the same hail of bullets that killed the prisoners. The effects of Attica are hard to measure. 2 months after the revolt at Attica, men at Norfolk Prison in Massachusetts began to organize. On November 8, 1971, armed guards and state troopers, in a surprise raid, moved into the cells at Norfolk, pulled out 16 men, and shipped them out. A prisoner described the scene. "Between 1 and 2 last night, I was awakened. I've been a light sleeper since Vietnam. And I looked out my window. There were troopers and screws, lots, armed with sidearms and big clubs. They were going into dorms and taking people, all kinds of people. They took a friend of mine. Being pulled outside in our underwear at 1:30, in bare feet by 2 troopers and a house screw. Looking at those troops with guns and masks and clubs, and the moon shining off the helmets and the hate that you could see in their faces. Thinking that this is where these guys live, with the guns and the hate and the helmets and masks. And you're trying to wake up, flashing on Kent State and Jackson and Chicago. And Attica. Most of all, Attica." That same week at Concord Prison in Massachusetts, another raid. It was as if everywhere in the weeks and months after Attica, the authorities were taking preventive action to break up organizing efforts among the prisoners. Jerry Souza, a young leader of the prison reform movement at Concord, was taken away, dumped into Walpole in the middle of the night, and immediately put into 9 Block, the dreaded segregation unit. He had been there only a short time when he managed to get a report out to friends. The content of this report tells much about what was happening before and after Attica to the thinking of prisoners. "We are writing a somber report regarding the circumstances and events leading up to and surrounding the death of prisoner Joseph Chesnulovich, which occurred here an hour ago in 9 Block. Since Christmas Eve, vicious prison guards here in 9 Block have created a reign of terror directed toward us prisoners. 4 of us have been beaten, one who was prisoner Donald King. In an attempt to escape constant harassment and inhuman treatment, prisoner George Hayes ate razor blades and prisoner Fred Ahern swallowed a needle. They were both rushed to Mass General Hospital. This evening at 6 p.m., prison guards Baptist, Sainsbury, and Montiega turned a fire extinguisher containing a chemical foam on Joe, then slammed the solid steel door, sealing him in his cell, and walked away, voicing threats of, "We'll get that punk." At 9:25 p.m., Joe was found dead. Prison authorities, as well as news media, will label little Joe's death a suicide, but the men here in Block 9 who witnessed this murder know. But are we next? What was happening was the organization of prisoners, the caring of prisoners for one another, the attempt to take the hatred and anger of individual rebellion and turn it into collective effort for change. On the outside, something new was also happening. The development of prison support groups all over the country, the building of a body of literature about prisons. There were more studies of crime and punishment, a growing movement for the abolition of prisons on the grounds that they did not prevent crime or cure it, but expanded it. Alternatives were discussed. Community houses in the short run, except for the incorrigibly violent, guaranteed minimum economic security in the long run. The prisoners were thinking about issues beyond prison, victims other than themselves and their friends. In Walpole Prison, a statement asking for American withdrawal from Vietnam was circulated. It was signed by every single prisoner, an amazing organizing feat by a handful of inmates. One Thanksgiving day there, most of the prisoners, not only in Walpole, but in 3 other prisons, refused to eat the special holiday meal, saying they wanted to bring attention to the hungry all over the United States. Prisoners worked laboriously on lawsuits, and some victories were won in the courts. The publicity around Attica, the community of support, had its effect. Although the Attica rebels were indicted on heavy charges and faced double and triple life terms, the charges were finally dropped. But in general, the courts declared their unwillingness to enter the closed, controlled world of the prison, and so the prisoners remained as they had been so long, on their own. Even where an occasional victory came in the courts, it turned out, on close reading, to leave things not much different. In 1973, Procunier versus Martinet, the U.S. Supreme Court declared unconstitutional certain male censorship regulations at the California Department of Corrections. But when one looked closely, the decision, with all its proud language about First Amendment liberties, said, "We hold that censorship of prison mail is justified if the following criteria are met. When the censorship could be said to further an important or substantial government interest, or where it was in the substantial government interest of security, order, and rehabilitation, censorship would be allowed." In 1978, the Supreme Court ruled that the news media do not have guaranteed rights of access to jails and prisons. It ruled also that prison authorities could forbid inmates to speak to one another, assemble, or spread literature about the formation of a prisoner's union. It became clear, and prisoners seemed to know this from the start, that their condition would not be changed by law, but by protest, organization, resistance, the creation of their own culture, their own literature, the building of links with people on the outside. There were more outsiders now who knew about prisons. Tens of thousands of Americans had spent time behind bars in the civil rights and anti-war movements. They had learned about the prison system and could hardly forget their experiences. There was a basis now for breaking through the long isolation of the prisoners from the community and finding support there. In the mid-70s, this was beginning to happen. It was a time of upsurge. Women guarded in their very homes rebelled. Prisoners put out of sight and behind bars rebelled. The greatest surprise was still to come. It was thought that the Indians, once the only occupants of the continent, then pushed back and annihilated by the white invaders, would not be heard from again. In the last days of the year 1890, shortly after Christmas, the last massacre of Indians took place at Pine Ridge, South Dakota, near Wounded Knee Creek. Sitting Bull, the great Sioux leader, had just been assassinated by Indian police in the pay of the United States, and the remaining Sioux sought refuge at Pine Ridge, 120 men and 230 women and children, surrounded by U.S. cavalry, with two Hotchkiss guns, capable of hurling shells over 2 miles, on a rise overlooking the camp. When the troopers ordered the Indians to turn over their weapons, one of them fired his rifle. The soldiers then let loose with their carbines, and the big guns on the hill shelled the teepees. When it was over, between 200 and 300 of the original 350 men, women, and children were dead. The 25 soldiers who died were mostly hit by their own shrapnel or bullets, since the Indians had only a few guns. The Indian tribes, attacked, subdued, starved out, had been divided up by putting them on reservations where they lived in poverty. In 1887, an allotment act tried to break up the reservations into small plots of land owned by individual Indians to turn them into American-type small farmers, but much of this land was taken by white speculators and the reservations remained. Then, during the New Deal, with a friend of the Indians, John Collier, in charge of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, there was an attempt to restore tribal life. But in the decades that followed, no fundamental change took place. Many Indians stayed on the impoverished reservations. The younger ones often left. An Indian anthropologist said, "An Indian reservation is the most complete colonial system in the world that I know about." For a time, the disappearance or amalgamation of the Indians seemed inevitable. Only 300,000 were left at the turn of the century, from the original million or more in the area of the United States. But then the population began to grow again, as if a plant left to die refused to do so, began to flourish. By 1960, there were 800,000 Indians, half on reservations, half in towns all over the country. The autobiographies of Indians show their refusal to be absorbed by the white man's culture. One wrote, "Oh yes, I went to the white man's schools. I learned to read from school books, newspapers, and the Bible. But in time I found that these were not enough. Civilized people depend too much on man-made printed pages. I turn to the Great Spirit's book, which is the whole of his creation. A Hopi Indian named Sun Chief said, I had learned many English words and could recite part of the Ten Commandments. I knew how to sleep on a bed, pray to Jesus, comb my hair, eat with a knife and fork, and use a toilet. I had also learned that a person thinks with his head instead of his heart. Chief Luther Standing Bear, in his 1933 autobiography, From the Land of the Spotted Eagle, wrote, True, the white man brought great change, but the varied fruits of his civilization, though highly colored and inviting, are sickening and deadening. And if it be the part of civilization to maim, rob, and thwart, then what is progress? I am going to venture that the man who sat on the ground and in his teepee, meditating on life and its meaning, accepting the kinship of all creatures, and acknowledging unity with the universe of things, was infusing into his being the true essence of civilization. As the civil rights and anti-war movements developed in the 1960s, Indians were already gathering their energy for resistance, thinking about how to change their situation, beginning to organize. In 1961, 500 tribal and urban Indian leaders met in Chicago. Out of this came another gathering of university-educated young Indians who formed the National Indian Youth Council. Mel Tom, a Paiute Indian, their first president, wrote, There is increased activity over on the Indian side. There are disagreements, laughing, singing, outbursts of anger, and occasionally some planning. Indians are gaining confidence and courage that their cause is right. The struggle goes on. Indians are gathering together to deliberate their destiny. Around this time, Indians began to approach the United States government on an embarrassing topic: treaties. In his widely read 1969 book, Custer Died for Your Sins, Vine Deloria Jr. noted that President Lyndon Johnson talked about America's commitments and President Nixon talked about Russia's failure to respect treaties. He said, Indian people laugh themselves sick when they hear these statements. The United States government had signed more than 400 treaties with Indians and violated every single one. For instance, back in George Washington's administration, a treaty was signed with the Iroquois of New York. The United States acknowledged all the land within the aforementioned boundaries to be the property of the Seneca Nation. But in the early 60s, under President Kennedy, the United States ignored the treaty and built a dam on this land, flooding most of the Seneca Reservation. Resistance was already taking shape in various parts of the country. In the state of Washington, there was an old treaty taking land from the Indians but leaving them fishing rights. This became unpopular as the white population grew and wanted the fishing areas exclusively for themselves. When state courts closed river areas to Indian fishermen in 1964, Indians had fish-ins on the Nisqually River in defiance of the court orders and went to jail, hoping to publicize their protest. A local judge the following year ruled that the Puyallup tribe did not exist, and its members could not fish on the river named for them, the Puyallup River. Policemen raided Indian fishing groups, destroyed boats, slashed nets, manhandled people, arrested 7 Indians. A Supreme Court ruling in 1968 confirmed Indian rights under the treaty, but said a state could regulate all fishing if it did not discriminate against Indians. The state continued to get injunctions and to arrest Indians fishing. They were doing to the Supreme Court ruling what whites in the South had done with the 14th Amendment for many years, ignoring it. Protests, raids, arrests continued into the early 70s. Some of the Indians involved in the fish-ins were veterans of the Vietnam War. One was Sid Mills, who was arrested in a fish-in at Frank's Landing on the Nisqually River in Washington on October 13, 1968. He made a statement. I am a Yakima and Cherokee Indian, and a man. For 2 years and 4 months, I've been a soldier in the United States Army. I served in combat in Vietnam until critically wounded. I hereby renounce further obligation in service or duty to the United States Army. My first obligation now lies with the Indian people, fighting for the lawful treaty to fish in usual and accustomed water of the Nisqually, Columbia, and other rivers of the Pacific Northwest, and in serving them in this fight in any way possible. My decision is influenced by the fact that we have already buried Indian fishermen returned dead from Vietnam, while Indian fishermen live here without protection and under steady attack. Just 3 years ago today, on October 13, 1965, 19 women and children were brutalized by more than 45 armed agents of the state of Washington at Frank's Landing on the Nisqually River in a vicious, unwarranted attack. Interestingly, the oldest human skeletal remains ever found in the Western Hemisphere were recently uncovered on the banks of the Columbia River, the remains of Indian fishermen. What kind of government or society would spend millions of dollars to pick upon our bones, restore our ancestral life patterns, and protect our ancient remains from damage, while at the same time eating upon the flesh of our living people? We will fight for our rights. Indians fought back not only with physical resistance, but also with the artifacts of white culture, books, words, newspapers. In 1968, members of the Mohawk Nation at Akwesasne, on the St. Lawrence River between the United States and Canada, began a remarkable newspaper, Akwesasne Notes, with news, editorials, poetry, all flaming with the spirit of defiance. Mixed in with all that was an irrepressible humor. Vine Deloria Jr. wrote, "Every now and then I am impressed with the thinking of the non-Indian. I was in Cleveland last year and got to talking with a non-Indian about American history. He said that he was really sorry about what had happened to Indians, but that there was a good reason for it. The continent had to be developed, and he felt that Indians had stood in the way, and thus it had to be removed. After all," he remarked, "what did you do with the land when you had it?" I didn't understand him until later when I discovered that the Cuyahoga River, running through Cleveland, is inflammable. So many combustible pollutants are dumped into the river that the inhabitants have to take special precautions during the summer to avoid setting it on fire. After reviewing the argument of my non-Indian friend, I decided that he was probably correct. Whites had made better use of the land. How many Indians could have thought of creating an inflammable river? In 1969, November 9th, there took place a dramatic event which focused attention on Indian grievances as nothing else had. It burst through the invisibility of previous local Indian protests and declared to the entire world that the Indians still lived and would fight for their rights. On that day, before dawn, 78 Indians landed on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay and occupied the island. Alcatraz was an abandoned federal prison, a hated and terrible place, nicknamed The Rock. In 1964, some young Indians had occupied it to establish an Indian university, but they were driven off, and there was no publicity. This time, it was different. The group was led by Richard Oakes, a Mohawk, who directed Indian studies at San Francisco State College, and Grace Thorpe, a Sac and Fox Indian, daughter of Jim Thorpe, the famous Indian college football star and Olympic runner, jumper, hurdler. More Indians landed, and by the end of November, nearly 600 of them, representing more than 50 tribes, were living on Alcatraz. They called themselves Indians of all tribes and issued a proclamation, "We hold the Rock." In it, they offered to buy Alcatraz in glass beads and red cloth, the price paid Indians for Manhattan Island over 300 years earlier. They said, "We feel that this so-called Alcatraz Island is more than suitable for an Indian reservation, as determined by the white man's own standards. By this, we mean that this place resembles most Indian reservations in that, 1, it is isolated from modern facilities and without adequate means of transportation. 2, it has no fresh running water. 3, it has inadequate sanitation facilities. 4, there are no oil or mineral rights. 5, there is no industry, and so unemployment is very great. 6, there are no health care facilities. 7, the soil is rocky and non-productive, and the land does not support game. 8, there are no educational facilities. 9, the population has always exceeded the land base. 10, the population has always been held as prisoners and dependent upon others. They announced they would make the island a center for Native American studies for ecology. "We will work to depollute the air and waters of the Bay Area, restore fish and animal life." In the months that followed, the government cut off telephones, electricity, and water to Alcatraz Island. Many of the Indians had to leave, but others insisted on staying. A year later, they were still there, and they sent out a message to our brothers and sisters of all races and tongues upon our Earth Mother. "We are still holding the island of Alcatraz in the true names of freedom, justice, and equality, because you, our brothers and sisters of this earth, have lent support to our just cause. We reach out our hands and hearts and send spirit messages to each and every one of you. We hold the rock. We have learned that violence breeds only more violence, and we therefore have carried on our occupation of Alcatraz in a peaceful manner, hoping that the government of these United States will also act accordingly. We are a proud people. We are Indians. We have observed and rejected much of what so-called civilization offers. We are Indians. We will preserve our tradition and ways of life by educating our own children. We are Indians. We will join hands in a unity never before put into practice. We are Indians. Our Earth Mother awaits our voices. We are Indians of all tribes. We hold the rock." 6 months later, federal forces invaded the island and physically removed the Indians living there. It had been thought that the Navajo Indians would not be heard from again. In the mid-1800s, United States troops under Kit Carson burned Navajo villages, destroyed their crops and orchards, forced them from their lands. But in the Black Mesa of New Mexico, they never surrendered. In the late 1960s, the Peabody Coal Company began strip mining on their land, a ruthless excavation of the topsoil. The company pointed to a contract signed with some Navajos. It was reminiscent of the treaties signed with some Indians in the past that took away all Indian land. 150 Navajos met in the spring of 1969 to declare that the strip mining would pollute the water and the air, destroy the grazing land for livestock, use up their scarce water resources. A young woman pointed to a public relations pamphlet put out by the Peabody Coal Company, showing fishing lakes, grassland, trees, and said, "We're not going to have anything like those you see in the pictures. What is the future going to be like for our children, our children's children?" An elderly Navajo woman, one of the organizers of the meeting, said, "Peabody's monsters are digging up the heart of our Mother Earth, our sacred mountain, and we also feel the pains. I have lived here for years, and I'm not about to move." The Hopi Indians were also affected by the Peabody operations. They wrote to President Nixon in protest. "Today, the sacred lands where the Hopi live are being desecrated by men who seek coal and water from our soil that they may create more power for the white man's cities. The Great Spirit said not to allow this to happen. The Great Spirit said not to take from the earth, not to destroy living things. It is said by the Great Spirit that if a gourd of ashes is dropped upon the earth, that many men will die, and that the end of this way of life is near at hand. We interpret this as the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We do not want to see this happen to any place or any nation again, but instead, we should turn all this energy for peaceful uses, not for war." In the fall of 1970, a magazine called La Raza, one of the countless local publications coming out of the movements of those years to supply information ignored in the regular media, told about the Pitt River Indians of Northern California. 60 Pitt Indians occupied land they said belonged to them. They defied the Forest Services when ordered to leave. One of them, Darrell B. Wilson, later recalled, "As the flames danced orange, making the trees come to life, and the cold creeped out of the darkness to challenge the speaking fire, and our breath came in small clouds. We spoke." They asked the government by what treaty it claimed the land. It could point to none. They cited a federal statute, 25 U.S.C.A. 194, that where there was a land dispute between Indian and white, the burden of proof falls on the white man. They had built a Quonset hut, and the marshals told them it was ugly and ruined the landscape. Wilson wrote later, "The whole world is rotting. The water is poisoned, the air polluted, the politics deformed, the land gutted, the forest pillaged, the shores ruined, the towns burned, the lives of the people destroyed." And the Federals spent the best part of October trying to tell us the Quonset hut was ugly. To us, it was beautiful. It was the beginning of our school, the meeting place, home for our homeless, a sanctuary for those needing rest, our church, our headquarters, our business office, our symbol of approaching freedom, and it still stands. It was also the center for the reviving of our stricken, diluted, and separated culture, our beginning. It was our sun rising on a clear spring day when the sky holds no clouds. It was a good and pure thing for the heart to look upon. That small place on earth, our place. But 150 marshals came with machine guns, shotguns, rifles, pistols, riot sticks, mace, dogs, chains, manacles. The old people were frightened. The young questioned bravery. The small children were like a deer that has been shot by the thunder stick. Hearts beat fast as though a race was just run in the heat of summer. The marshals began swinging their riot sticks and blood started flowing. Wilson grabbed one marshal's club, was thrown down, manacled, and while lying face down on the ground, was struck behind the head several times. A 66-year-old man was beaten into unconsciousness. A white reporter was arrested, his wife beaten. They were all thrown into trucks and taken away, charged with assaulting state and federal officers and cutting trees, but not with trespassing, which might have brought into question the ownership of the land. When the episode was all over, they were still defiant. Indians who had been in the Vietnam War made connections. At the Winter Soldier investigations in Detroit, where Vietnam veterans testified about their experiences, an Oklahoma Indian named Evan Haney told about his. The same massacres happened to the Indians 100 years ago. Germ warfare was used then. They put smallpox in the Indians' blankets. I got to know the Vietnamese people, and I learned they were just like us. What we are doing is destroying ourselves and the world. I have grown up with racism all my life. When I was a child, watching cowboys and Indians on TV, I would root for the cavalry, not the Indians. It was that bad. I was that far toward my own destruction. Though 50% of the children at the country school I attended in Oklahoma were Indians, nothing in school, on television, or on the radio taught anything about Indian culture. There were no books on Indian history, not even in the library. But I knew something was wrong. I started reading and learning my own culture. I saw the Indian people at their happiest when they went to Alcatraz or to Washington to defend their fishing rights. They at last felt like human beings. Indians began to do something about their own destruction, the annihilation of their culture. In 1969, at the first convocation of American Indian scholars, Indians spoke indignantly of either the ignoring or the insulting of Indians in textbooks given to little children all over the United States. That year, the Indian Historian Press was founded. It evaluated 400 textbooks in elementary and secondary schools and found that not one of them gave an accurate depiction of the Indian. A counterattack began in the schools. In early 1971, 45 Indian students at Copper Valley School in Glen Allen, Alaska, wrote a letter to their congressman opposing the Alaska oil pipeline as ruinous to the ecology, a threat to the peace, quiet, and security of our Alaska. Other Americans were beginning to pay attention, to rethink their own learning. The first motion pictures attempting to redress the history of the Indian appeared. One was Little Big Man, based on a novel by Thomas Berger. More and more books appeared on Indian history, until a whole new literature came into existence. Teachers became sensitive to the old stereotypes, threw away the old textbooks, started using new material. In the spring of 1977, a teacher named Jane Califf in the New York City elementary schools told of her experiences with fourth and fifth grade students. She brought into class the traditional textbooks and asked the students to locate the stereotypes in them. She read aloud from Native American writers and articles from Akwesasne Notes and put protest posters around the room. The children then wrote letters to the editors of the books they had read. "Dear Editor, I don't like your book called The Cruise of Christopher Columbus. I didn't like it because you said some things about Indians that weren't true. Another thing I didn't like was on page 69, it says that Christopher Columbus invited the Indians to Spain, but what really happened was that he stole them. Sincerely, Raymond Miranda. On Thanksgiving Day, 1970, at the annual celebration of the landing of the Pilgrims, the authorities decided to do something different. Invite an Indian to make the celebratory speech. They found a Wampanoag Indian named Frank James and asked him to speak. But when they saw the speech he was about to deliver, they decided they did not want it. His speech, not heard at Plymouth, Massachusetts, on that occasion, said in part, the whole speech is in Chronicles of American Indian Protest, "I speak to you as a man, a Wampanoag man. It is with mixed emotions that I stand here to share my thoughts. The Pilgrims had hardly explored the shores of Cape Cod 4 days before they had robbed the graves of my ancestors and stolen their corn, wheat, and beans. Our spirit refuses to die. Yesterday we walked the woodland paths and sandy trails. Today we must walk the macadam highways and roads. We are uniting. We're standing not in our wigwams, but in your concrete tent. We stand tall and proud, and before too many moons pass, we'll right the wrongs we have allowed to happen to us." For Indians, there has never been a clear line between prose and poetry. When an Indian studying in New Mexico was praised for his poetry, he said, "In my tribe, we have no poets. Everyone talks in poetry." There are, however, poems, collected in William Brandon's The Last Americans and In the Way by Shirley Hill Witt and Stan Steiner. An Anishinaabe spring poem translated by Gerald Weisnor. "As my eyes look across the prairie, I feel the summer in the spring." "Snow at Last" by Joseph Concha. "Snow comes last, for it quiets down everything." This from a fifth-year group in a special Navajo program in the year 1940 called "It Is Not." "The Navajo Reservation a lonesome place? It is not. The skies are sunny, clear blue, or gray with rain. Each day is gay, in nature's way. It is not a lonesome place at all. A Navajo house shabby and small? It is not. Inside there's love, good laughter, and big talk. But best, it's home, with an open door and room for all. A castle could have no more." In March of 1973 came a powerful affirmation that the Indians of North America were still alive. On the site of the 1890 massacre on Pine Ridge Reservation, several hundred Oglala Sioux and friends returned to the village of Wounded Knee to occupy it as a symbol of the demand for Indian land, Indian rights. The history of that event, in the words of the participants, has been captured in a rare book published by Akwesasne Notes, Voices from Wounded Knee, 1973. In the 1970s, 54% of the adult males on the Pine Ridge Reservation were unemployed. One-third of the families were on welfare or pensions. Alcoholism was widespread, and suicide rates were high. The life expectancy of an Oglala Sioux was 46 years. Just before the Wounded Knee occupation, there was violence at the town of Custer. An Indian named Wesley Badheart Bull was killed by a white gas station attendant. The man was let out on $5,000 bond and indicted for manslaughter, facing a possible 10-year term. A gathering of Indians to protest this led to a clash with police. The murder victim's mother, Mrs. Sarah Badheart Bull, was arrested on charges that called for a maximum sentence of 30 years. On February 27, 1973, about 300 Oglala Sioux, many of them members of the new militant organization called the American Indian Movement, or AIM, entered the village of Wounded Knee and declared it liberated territory. Ellen Move's camp later said, "We decided that we did need the American Indian Movement in here because our men were scared. They hung to the back. It was mostly the women that went forward and spoke out." Within hours, more than 200 FBI agents, federal marshals, and police of the Bureau of Indian Affairs surrounded and blockaded the town. They had armored vehicles, automatic rifles, machine guns, grenade launchers, and gas shells, and soon began firing. Gladys Bissonette said 3 weeks later, "Since we are here in Wounded Knee, we've been shot at over and over, always after dark. But last night we were hit the hardest. I guess the Great Spirit is with us, and no bullets find their way into our bodies. We ran through a hail of bullets one night. We're going to hold our stand until we are completely an independent sovereign nation, Oglala Sioux Nation." After the siege began, food supplies became short. Indians in Michigan sent food via a plane that landed inside the encampment. The next day, FBI agents arrested the pilot and a doctor from Michigan who had hired the plane. In Nevada, 11 Indians were arrested for taking food, clothing, and medical supplies to South Dakota. In mid-April, three more planes dropped 1,200 pounds of food, but as people scrambled to gather it up, a government helicopter appeared overhead and fired down on them while ground fire came from all sides. Frank Clearwater, an Indian man lying on a cot inside a church, was hit by a bullet. When his wife accompanied him to a hospital, she was arrested and jailed. Clearwater died. There were more gun battles, another death. Finally, a negotiated peace was signed, in which both sides agreed to disarm. The Indians had refused to disarm while surrounded by armed men, recalling the 1890 massacre.